Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi from Cornell University and a former columnist, blogger, and now radio host for TurfNet, an online community of turf grass professionals found on the web at turfnet.com. Welcome to the unofficial start of the 2017 season of Frankly Speaking, and I'm excited that you are here with us, and thanks for putting us on your playlist. We have an excellent show to start the season live from the New England Turf Conference with University of Tennessee Professor Jim Brosnan and on the line with Penn State entomologist Professor Ben McGraw. This is an episode of Resistance Radio, pesticide resistance, that is. But first, we have to discuss sports with two degenerate New England sports fans. So I am here at the show with Professor Jim Brosnan from the University of Tennessee, weed scientist in the program there, and Professor Ben McGraw, Penn State University entomologist in the turf grass program out there. I can say, because I'm old, both young guys that I've known for a long time, and it's really great that we have these bright young minds sort of continuing to create new ideas for us to pursue. And our podcast, which was that we're doing tonight, it sort of was born at the Golf Industry Show in 2017. We were sitting around and answers on the, no, the doctor is in. And Ben and Jim and I were sitting there, and the conversation immediately deteriorated into how great the New England sports teams are, which, you know, as a guy from New York, this is, you know, I guess after 100 years of success that we've had in New York, one decade for the people in New England is the least they could get. So we're very happy for our New England friends, and I'm sure we're going to hear a little bit about how much Bill Belichick smiles these days and why we're interested in that.
I don't know, Frank. The Jets are working on 100 years themselves right now.
The Jets. I don't know. Joe Namath. I remember. I'm actually old enough to remember watching Joe Namath. So we're going to let it deteriorate into New England sports at some time, and we got to get Ben to that Bruin game if he can get it out there in State College on that cannon string, I think, that heads out to State College. Anyway, so you can imagine we're in for some fun conversation, but also some good information. And Ben recently published a paper in Golf Course Management that was a survey that he conducted, I just found out recently, when he got to the position he's in when he started in the program, asking about the behavior of golf course superintendents with regard to their control of annual bluegrass weevil, their insecticide use primarily, but also their general behavior about it. You know, where do they get their information? How are they using the materials? What do they know about potential resistance? And once we get to the resistance component, that's where we'll bring in Professor Brosnan here and talk more about not only resistance in weeds, but just the whole concept of what we're doing when we're making pesticide selection. So, Ben, let's start with you. Tell me about this survey. It looks pretty comprehensive. Looks like you got a good response in a wide range of areas where pressure is considered either strong or emerging strongly. I think the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia area, I would say, is one of those places where you might say it's emerging more. So why don't you give us a background of what you were trying to do here and what are the big points that you grabbed in a top page assessment of this work?
All right. Well, first of all, thanks, Frank, for having me on the show. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
I'll hang up and listen.
But you're exactly right. Like this survey that I conducted with my former PhD advisor, Albrecht Koppenhofer, part of my indentured servitude contract with him is to give him 1 to 2 papers per year after I've left.
After you've left.
And so, actually, really, you know, like, and good advice for any young faculty member starting a position, it's a good idea to get the lay of the land and the problems that essentially your constituents have. The insect that we work on, the annual bluegrass weevil, which is a big part of our lab, has this expanding distribution, so every year populations show up in new areas like Ohio or North Carolina into Virginia, and Pennsylvania has had a long history with it in the east, not so long in the west, and that was kind of the reasoning behind doing the survey, is to really, you know, kind of gauge the severity of the problem, kind of see where people are having problems, and to get an idea of what people are using for control. So there were a lot of questions involved in the survey. I think it was rather comprehensive. You know, after you do any survey, it's like, oh, God, I wish I had asked this instead of this. So there are some limitations to the survey, but management practices is a big one. Another part, we were going to begin this cultural project, cultural practices to reduce weevil severity in areas of the golf course, most particular putting greens where most of the insecticides are applied. So we had a lot of questions in regard to that. But there are some, definitely some interesting trends that popped up.
Well, and I want to say, let me draw your attention. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, where these, and a lot of this is, you know, self-identified stuff, right?
Yeah.
I was particularly interested in the location of the damage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Outside of really the state of Connecticut, right? Outside of the state, I guess maybe, yeah, the state of Connecticut and the northern periphery. I'm looking at greens.
Yep.
Greens seem to be an area not heavily where the damage is occurring.
Yeah, and that was a major push of this survey, is we wanted to develop best management practices for greens. I mean, it's a small area of the golf course, you know, what, 3 to 5 acres maybe in total. So it seems like, you know, to the outsider, why would you look to make changes on such a small acreage? But this is where, you know, most frequent inputs are as far as insecticides. If you've got a low budget course, they're going to spray their greens, not their fairways.
Right. Okay. So that's right. Small area,
yeah.
But of course, vital to the, well, the reason the course is there, right?
Right.
I think we say all the time that, you know, they'll suffer a lot of issues, but they're not going to suffer crappy greens.
Right. And coupled with that, I can tell you I've seen damage to putting surfaces twice in my life in the 12 years
right.
that I've been researching this. So.
Right. Yeah. So they're not seeing the damage on the greens, and I looked at this and I said, man, when I see the amount of damages, there's look at the location of the damage, the collar and approach and the fairway. But you're saying the majority of the applications are actually made to greens, not to the large expansive approaches or tees or fairways, or are they looping these areas? I guess you and I know they're doing a lot of looping of these areas. So talk to me about the relationship between where they identified the damage and how they use insecticides.
Yeah, so, I mean, in my experience, first I'll back up. If I'm called out to a golf course and somebody asks me to look at their weevil damage, I'd say 9 times out of 10 I can find it on the collar, but not within the interior of the putting surface. And if you look at the survey, you know, there's relatively, it's actually much higher than what I thought, but relatively lower percentage of people saying that they experience damage to putting surfaces. However, collars and approaches, you know, the immediate areas next to the putting surface are lit up. And nobody manages a collar differently from a putting surface as far as fertility or insecticide application. You might have some skips or the boom runs out, but in general, they're treated the same as the putting surface. So the one difference is mowing height.
Right.
And that really, this survey really kind of gave us some ideas to look into these, or at least give us a little bit more evidence that there may be an effect in mowing height. And
so did you see that? Because in this survey, you did report heights of cut.
Yeah.
Did you feel there was some relationship? Obviously, they're always mowing greens lower.
Yeah.
Did you see anything with how low they mowed and how much damage there was?
Yeah, it wasn't a perfect relationship, but a place like Long Island was experiencing 10% reported damage to greens.
Yeah.
And they were one of the lower mowing heights. They were tied with Western Pennsylvania as far as the low, or Western Pennsylvania was the lowest, and Long Island was slightly higher. Both areas had really low percentage of greens that were damaged. So it kind of gave us a strong indication that there was something going on with mowing height.
Okay, so that is an interesting takeaway, at least from this one piece that, you know, I always imagine that guys are out there making large scale applications to fairways and rough. And that's what makes, when you then say they're making 3.9 applications, almost 4 apps.
Yeah. So
now, is what I want to know is that 4 apps everywhere, four apps to greens. Where are they putting it the most?
Yeah, that's one of the limitations of the survey is we didn't really capture that. I would imagine is that you're making four applications, which I'm okay with in the modern era of annual bluegrass weevil management. You know, I would say 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and this might lead into where we're going next, 10 to 15 years ago, you could possibly make one application in springtime and it would be enough for the year. I mean, that's what reports in the literature would say.
Exactly right.
In the modern era of weevil management, you definitely are doing sequential applications. So, you know, an adulticide followed by a larvicide, followed by who knows whatever next for the next two applications on average. Many places are going well north of four applications per year. But most likely it could be a combination of probably one or two really broad spectrum, very broad applications, all fairways, all short mode surfaces, hopefully not rough, but we do know that people are applying to rough. And then it's probably a combination of spot treatments as well. So two broad area applied applications followed with two, you know, spot treatments would not be something that would raise my eyebrows.
Right. Okay. So, you know, when I start looking at this, there's a lot of things that jump out that, you know, 30% of the applications, 30% of the golf courses on Long Island are making more than five applications a year. And then you look at that a little more closely, it's almost three apps are just pyrethroids. Now, you know, that's, again, it's tough to get that out of this survey, but you'd hope that's, if you had to guess, please don't tell me you think that's three apps in the same spot. You think it's three apps, one on tees, one on fairways, one on greens?
No, I think you and I both know Long Island pretty well. It's a really interesting case study of how pesticide restrictions have good intentions, but can go terribly, terribly wrong. And Long Island is probably the toughest place. I can't. It's amazing that there are so many amazing golf courses on Long Island with a restricted amount of chemical tools that they have. Not that I'm a super believer that we should spray wall to wall and use chemicals until they go, but Long Island is really forced into a corner with pesticide restrictions because of the unique geological features of Long Island, shallow water.
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course. And yeah, sole source. I mean, everybody's drinking from the same thing.
I mean, some of the newer classes of insecticides that have been developed are not available on Long Island, even though they're much safer, have a much better environmental profile than these older classes of insecticides. And you would think, oh, that's crazy. Why wouldn't it be available there? Well, these older products have been grandfathered in, and the newer ones are under tight scrutiny in that part of the world, that it really forces the superintendent on Long Island to use these older chemistries. And when we don't have a huge buffet. When you talk to Jim or any of the pathology, like you know, Frank, the buffet is so much greater to choose from. We don't have, even outside of Long Island, we don't have a lot of options.
Yeah, and so that then, you know, of course, leads to the question, right? So now you see, particularly on Long Island where they're restricted, and for a variety of good reasons, not the least of which is what really got it all started was Temet contamination of the old potato,
from the old potato
fields out on the East End. So now we turn to what really got this resistance podcast going, and that is this particular concept that you seem to have identified. Again, limitations, and let me see if I can lay it out because I want you to spend time sort of talking about this. And then this is where we're going to start the conversation with Jim, who has some excellent resources as well in understanding herbicide resistance. And we'll do that when we come back after a message from our sponsors. But before we go there, Ben, the whole idea of pyrethroid use in particular, and you articulated it really well on Long Island where their hands are tied a little bit. So In this survey, you let superintendents self-identify if they felt they had susceptible or resistant populations, and at the same time, you ask them about the chemicals that they were using. And I'm looking at the article from Golf Course Management, figure three here, where it shows pyrethroids. There's a susceptible bar that says over 80% are using pyrethroids on susceptible populations, and about 50% said they had identified some form of what they thought was resistance. And that is over 60% of those guys identifying they had some form of resistance, they were still using pyrethroids. So did I read that right? And what do you make of that?
You did. I mean, I do have some critics of this survey, and the survey does have limitations. So I don't want to say that this is scientific, that we tested every population.
Yeah, but I don't care about that.
I know you
don't
care
about that. And this opponents, is my show.
my critics would say that you can make up statistics about anything. 44% of people know that. However, boom, boom, ching.
No, I don't know what that's a joke about.
So basically,
if
we can back up a little bit,
Yeah.
Pyrethroid resistance has been documented in the annual bluegrass weevil. And in our survey, what was reported in the region of the people who took the survey, one in five, or about 20%, suggested that they had a pyrethroid-resistant population, whether it was tested by university groups or kind of anecdotal, they had observed it from lack of control with the pyrethroid. Mm-hmm. The pyrethroids in a susceptible population are a highly, highly effective class of insecticide. So, you know, if you had never applied a pyrethroid to your population, that was the example where 10, 15 years ago, if you applied this, you might knock your population back so greatly that you wouldn't need another application for the year. So, you know, this was the number one class of insecticides used not only for adult control, but for weevil control. Mm-hmm. The people who have developed pyrethroid resistance or identified as deemed pyrethroid resistant, over 60% in our survey said they were still using pyrethroids, which is fairly shocking.
Well, that's, you know, therein lies, you know, the kind of question that this is what leads us to sort of say, if you're having to manage this pest, it seems like you ought to at least know if the 40-acre application you might be making to your fairways and rough or tees or greens or whatever you're going to be doing, especially if you're making three, but even not Long Island, Ben, a lot of places we're making, you know, 2.5. Connecticut, which has a lot of pyrethroid problems, is the only one that was making less than 2 pyrethroid apps. I mean, Massachusetts is making almost 4. So, you know, I look at that and I see what you're saying here. And, you know, I'm not really interested in sort of debating this, because I think at the end of the day, what then worries me is your survey indicates how few are adopting IPM techniques, right? And, you know, 8% were saying they were actually leaning towards that. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, and I think too, Ben, that we see this a lot in the herbicide world, is that there's a number of different ways to rationalize your way out of a bad application. And I think most folks that are seeing product failure are picking those avenues of rationalizing the failure, and one of those isn't actually resistance. And then when the survey comes out to say, well, we've had failed control, and if failed control is resistance, then yeah, maybe we have it, that could explain why the percentage is so high. We certainly see that on the herbicide side, that you get the, we didn't have the right weather for the product to perform the way that we thought it would. It just broke early, or the sellout of the spray applicator is one. Well, it wasn't applied right. It wasn't mixed right. The equipment wasn't calibrated. And you can go through this litany of rationalizations to kind of cover up what the central issue is for a number of years before it comes to light.
Before it comes to light, and when we come back. And so that's a perfect transition, and you heard the dulcet tones of Jim Brosnan here, live from Providence, Rhode Island. And I'm joined with Professor Ben McGraw and Jim Brosnan here on Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back after a message from our sponsors. Superintendents all agree that traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, Improves gas exchange and mends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the surface smooth and playable. And I can testify, I've been involved with a number of projects where DryJect was used, and that is, in fact, true, that it's not very noticeable by the golfers. Best of all, the independent DryJect service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. DryJect, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. You can visit DryJect.com to locate your nearest DryJect service center and tell them that you're a listener to Frankly Speaking. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm here live in Providence, Rhode Island. Professor Jim Brosnan on the line with Professor Ben McGraw, that I like to keep reminding them, two young, degenerate New England sports fans, but we're going to try our best not to wander through. I think you guys, has it been the Celtics, the Bruins, the Red Sox, and the Patriots in a decade or so? When did the Bruins win last?
The Bruins won in 2011. June 15th, if you want to.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, you know, who's counting? Yeah. Was that when they had that nutball goalie that then wouldn't go to the White House?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Tim Thomas. What he's doing now, nobody knows.
So he's not in the league anymore?
I don't believe so.
I believe he's the Secretary of Defense.
Okay. So when was the last time the Celtics won then?
I think 2008. That was the KG, Paul Pierce, right. Ray Allen team.
That's right. And then, of course, the Red Sox have been three times now?
I believe that's right.
Yeah.
And the Patriots all since 2000, right? All five of them.
2001, technically. Super Bowl was in 02.
You know, I don't know where we can go with this, fellas.
We other keep than, talking about
other
this
than
all day.
You know, you have to remember, there was 80 years of people who lived and died and never saw the Red Sox or the Patriots win anything. So I'm sure it's been a happy time, but we're not going to let it again degrade into that, Jim. We're going to pitch it to you now that Ben set us up nicely. And really, I think, you know, the behavior that our turf managers have to follow. And, you know, Ben, you didn't get a chance to talk about it, but before we went live, you said you've also read in other pest worlds where people continue to use products where they know resistance. I believe you said it was the mosquito world as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, look, we deal in turf, but there are definitely human health issues with you know, malaria transmission.
Yeah.
You know, pyrethroid resistance is big in the mosquito world. Much bigger stakes at play there. Houseflies, you know, I was reading one of your colleagues at Cornell's papers today about pyrethroid resistance and the lack of control of pyrethroids there, and farmers are still using it in housefly control. So,
In livestock.
Yeah, and right. I do think that there is an underlying component to this. It's, you know, we often overlook the social aspect of pest management decisions. And let's face it, pyrethroids are incredibly inexpensive.
That's exactly
and
right.
So, you know, not to toot my own horn with the survey or go back to the survey, but toot. if you look at Massachusetts and northern New England, like where I'm from, that was some of the highest pyrethroid use. Mm-hmm. And that's not typically an area that you associate with a lot of high
ABW pressure.
Yeah, high ABW pressure, or even you know, golf courses that would be spraying on a regular basis.
So,
that's probably
I see
the
where
only
I, yeah,
insecticide
yeah.
applications they're making, because
right.
they're inexpensive. Any budget right. operation can make into pyrethroid applications.
That's right. So I think, Jim, before we get to the question about the weed behavior, is it possible McGraw is pining to come back to the New England states and be an entomologist up in Maine, maybe?
Hey, who knows?
Okay, Jim. So where Ben left us now is this behavior of using materials and not knowing resistance appears to be a topic you've addressed head on in the weed world. So I want to talk about the two tools that you've recently developed, but I want you to put the resistance issue in context. I had a conversation on Frankly Speaking with Paul Vincelli about herbicide resistance and pesticide use and the selection stuff. And certainly in my small mind, it's hard to not think that what we're observing, where genetically modified crops have been chemically developed, you know, developed to be resistant to the chemicals, that has led to a ramping up in herbicide resistance. And we're seeing it
at a much slower pace and in an earlier phase beginning to happen in turf. Is that a good sort of setting point for maybe where we are now?
Yeah, most definitely. And before we jump into it, thank you again for having me on the show. Oh. As Ben said, you know, longtime listener, first time caller.
So great.
So it's really great to be here and talk about this area that we work a lot in, my team at Tennessee. And kudos to you, Ben, on a great survey. I'd say that one of the things we lack in the weed science world right now is the type of survey that you did on a regional scale. As extension specialists who, you know, cover weed science, I think anyone in any state in the Southeast would say that resistance is the number one thing that we work on. But we don't have any really hard numbers on how many cases are out there in turf grass systems in Tennessee, in what weeds versus how does that differ from Georgia or Mississippi or Virginia or Texas. I'm part of a big team of researchers right now trying to get a USDA SCRI grant to try to generate those sort of numbers as a large regional survey. But the success of that is always kind of a wild card. So we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to be funding agriculture in the United States.
Who knows? But, you know, our kind of delve into the resistance area kind of came head on from site visits with golf course superintendents, basically calling about product failures and wanting to know what could be going on, taking some of those plants back, running them through some traditional dose response experiments to try to generate resistance. And over and over again, we continue to see these resistance cases come up. You know, to mirror Ben's survey a little, myself and Gerald Henry from the University of Georgia, and then Aaron Patton from Purdue, we do workshops at the GIS every year, and we do a pre-workshop questionnaire for attendees, and we split it for the northern part of the country and the southern part of the country. And the response rate, one of the questions is, you know, do you feel that you have some degree of herbicide resistance at your golf course? Mm-hmm. And in the south, that ranges between 40-60% of attendees saying yes.
Really?
In the north, it's really not as high of a number. And I think some of that is the nature of the weeds that we're treating. There's probably more herbicide applications in the south just by the nature of dormant warm season grasses more susceptible to weed infestation. And I think at some level, it's a little bit easier to see in a warm season turf grass system. You know, you think about a dormant Bermuda grass that's a straw brown with annual bluegrass plants that have now escaped a herbicide application. That's a stark visual contrast.
So being able to just see it is a component, right? And so, you know, Ben in the insecticide world has to live sort of, if it doesn't work, then you see the damage, right? And in the case of the weed world, with that beautiful picture you have of the poa, the glyphosate-resistant poa that, you know, is there with the one yellow and the one green, some of it is that you can see it, and yet, just like Ben found in his insecticide work, these superintendents in the Southeast that are reporting 40-60% reporting herbicide resistance, they're probably continuing to use the same types of materials. And as we've talked before, a lot of that is, like Ben said about Long Island, there's not a lot of new chemistry. There's not a lot of options, which, you know, bottlenecks the whole selection pressure a step further from just how many apps you make versus how many apps you make of the same sort of class of materials.
No, that's exactly right. And what we're trying to do as extension folks is really push the education piece that, you know, if you contrast what's done, say, for disease management in a turf grass system, there's a ton of thought that is put into building a disease management plan, say, on putting greens to go through an entire season. And we think about those programs, and those programs have tank mixtures, they have multiple applications, multiple modes of action, and resistance is certainly at the forefront of what those programs are trying to do and manage the onset of fungal pathogens with resistance characteristics.
Yeah, sure.
And when we contrast that with what's done on the weed science side, the effort piece is shocking, right? You know, you think about the thought that goes into that disease management plan, you contrast that with what's done on the weed science side of, well, I'm going to put out the same pre-emergence product I've always put out in spring and clean up any escapes with the same product I've used to clean up escapes with. end of discussion.
And because how much does that cost? And, even to treat 50 acres?
And repeat that over time. We're really trying to break that cycle. And, you know, I gave presentations here this morning trying to, you know, use this as an opportunity at the beginning of a season to kind of change that mindset, reevaluate your program. And if you've had some failures, knowing that this resistance problem is a real thing, maybe this is the time for you to alter some of the pieces of that program, given that a lot of the weeds that you're treating are these massive seed producers that can deposit hundreds of thousands of viable seed in soil.
So, you know, it's funny. You know, I want to get to the tools that you've developed, because I do think, like Ben did successfully with the survey, and you're doing with this regional group, with the surveys that you're doing, but also the diagnostic tools and to help them manage through it, is what are the options, Jim? I mean, if you're growing grass in Tennessee, not for nothing, but it's a heck of a lot harder than it is in Pittsburgh and in the metropolitan New York area when it comes to weed pressure. If you don't spray a pre-emerger for crabgrass, what are your options, my brother? I don't really know what you can do, right? What can you do?
I mean, we have, you know, as Ben kind of noted when he was talking about the situation on Long Island, we do have tools. I think the problem comes into the mindset of the golf course superintendent of I call it an I spray product X for weed Y mentality. That you get into this, it's almost like a marriage that, you know, Revolver becomes my POA product and that's all I'm ever going to spray. And we don't really think beyond that once we find kind of a herbicide that fits a particular niche at the facility. And we really need to break that. I mean, you talked about the diagnostic center a minute ago, and that really just grew out of need.
Yeah.
That our group was being taxed with doing so many resistance confirmations for folks that we felt, hey, there's a real need here to have this be a formalized service. That we were getting superintendents continuing to want this information.
Because they saw the weeds not dead.
Yes.
They knew they made the application they've been married to forever, and it didn't work out like it normally did. They picked up that plant and shipped it to you.
Yeah, and in many cases, what it is needed at some of these clubs is a justification for maybe some additional budget dollars to use maybe a more expensive chemistry for control. And going through the formal process of generating the information about why the product failed and why they need to do something different has helped many. I will give one superintendent, in case he's listening, credit. At Hyde Park Golf Club outside of Cincinnati, Patrick O'Brien, he was a real forward thinker. He saw the Weed Diagnostic Center come about and actually sent samples in for susceptibility testing. And his rationale was, before I go spend budget dollars to make this application to control this weed, I want to make sure that my plants are susceptible to what I'm going to spray. And ran them through the same test that we do to confirm resistance, but he wanted to confirm susceptibility.
And how wide is the tool, Jim? This is spectacular. Ben, I'm going to ask you in a minute. I know Rich Cowell does pyrethroid resistant testing. So before we get to you, Jim, how many chemicals can you screen these products for resistance to?
Well, I mean, it really depends on the method that you want to go about doing it, right? So we've worked on and have developed, we call it a rapid diagnostic assay, where we can get information in about 10 to 14 days. And that's really applicable to glyphosate. It's really applicable to the ALS inhibitors like Revolver or Monument, things like that. And the dinitrogenin. So we can screen in hydroponics, prodiamine, dithiapyr, herbicides like that, and give the superintendent a really quick answer. For some of the other chemistries out there, it's a slower process because we don't have the rapid assays really finalized, and you have to go through the traditional process of taking those plants that have survived an application, growing them out for seed, then germinating that seed, and then doing some rate titration experiments, which is a lot more complicated and timely. There's a big push to try to do more of this rapid testing and to incorporate some molecular things, which are beyond my skill set, but luckily I've got some nice smart friends that are
and grad students
that are knowledgeable in
grad
that, that are knowledgeable in that area that can go in and, you know, quickly extract some DNA and look for a target site mutation or some other property that's causing.
I mean, when I hear you talk like this about our ability to screen weeds like this, I immediately start thinking about mapping the populations on my golf course and then GPS rigging my sprayer I don't even need remote sensing on the spray rig. If you do proper scouting, mm-hmm. you can identify these populations. It's not like there's a lot of weeds growing on most of the golf courses that we deal with. So, Ben, let me ask you about your resistance testing before we get back to Jim again. That is, am I right about that, that Cowles has got that thing at that he does? Does everybody do that? Is that what you do? Talk to me about how guys can confirm pyrethroid resistance, because I bet with the so many listeners we have, you guys may be doing some business on the other side of this thing, and you can send your check to Belcanto Farm in the hills of central New York. So tell me about resistance testing for the weevils for pyrethroids, I imagine.
Well, you're right, Rich Coles. Back in the mid-2000s, that's kind of when I was doing my PhD, and many others were coming through school at that same time, and when pyrethroid resistance really kind of emerged on the scene. I think that was 2006. So Rich developed a test basically using field product or technical grade pyrethroids. The limitations of it, much quicker turnaround than what Jim is talking about. Within 3 days, we can have an answer.
Yeah, it's really, petri dish right? It's petri dish blotter paper stuff.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's basically a petri dish. However, the real limitation is the number of insects. So you'd have to get insects in sufficient quantities. You know, I would suggest like a minimum of 100 to 200 insects, which is, you know, no easy task for the layperson or the superintendent.
That's a lot of lemon joy.
Yeah, and you can't use lemon joy because then, you know, they'll probably die from the soap. So so there's lots of limitations to overcome. I don't believe that Rich provides that service anymore, and I don't think he has for many years.
Oh.
We do it in our lab. Ideally, you have a susceptible population that you can compare it to, and we do have those populations where they, you know, like the college golf course at Delhi, where I took my first faculty job. I never had applied a pyrethroid against their population, so incredibly sensitive, really nice population to compare. So there are some limitations with the test. You know, having that susceptible population that you can compare it to is one. The number of insects is another. And then finally, you really need to test it before any insecticides go out. So there's a narrow window where you could collect weevils, you know, essentially from their emergence, which we'll probably see in another couple of weeks in earnest.
Oh, please.
before you make that first insecticide application, because after you make that first insecticide application, then you're wiping off all the susceptible ones, and it would only give you an elevated estimate of resistance. Same thing with other generations. You just don't know what you're dealing with. So it's a narrow window, lots of insects, and having the ability to collect them. So, I mean, the holy grail would be to have some sort of, you know, like pregnancy kit, basically, positive
exactly
yes
right.
or no.
Exactly
However,
right.
that brings us to another point about resistance in insects, and I would imagine that's the same with weeds, but I'm largely ignorant from that side of things, mostly because I lasted about a week in weeds class at UMass, but so boring. I had
to leave. No, was that? I don't know. Do I know who taught that class? It wasn't prostate.
Probably,
was it?
But anyway, I dropped that. Anyway, I didn't need it to graduate. So I digress. But the problem with resistance in insects is it's not an all or nothing. It's you know. Like with a pregnancy diagnostic kit, you're either pregnant or you're not. With resistance, you could be slightly resistant,
degrees, you could be moderately resistant,
you could be high
resistant. And that's what Jim was talking about with those susceptibility tests.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's degrees of resistance. I mean, and Ben, I'm sure the same is true for you when you go on a site visit for a potential resistance call. You're there when it's highly resistant. It's not often you're there when it's just starting to show signs of resistance.
Yeah, and I was thinking of that as you were talking, Jim, and I'm really impressed with your knowledge of not only New England sports championship dates. I don't even remember my kids' birthdays, barely. I mean, I remember the day. I don't remember what year they were born in. But
that was impressive.
Confess what, the reason I know that is I have this hobby, and this hobby is whenever a New England team wins a championship, I get the Boston Herald from the next day, and I frame it. And I have a hallway in my house, and my wife jokes about it. She calls it the Hall of Champions.
Is your poor wife from New England?
She married into it. It was in our vows.
Jim and I have a weird connection. Tragic. His wife's uncle was our lawyer in New York.
Yep.
Are you guys brothers?
No, but it was like the weirdest 6 degrees of Frank Rossi ever.
So weird. Okay, well, listen, here's what I want to let's wrap this up here. We'll take one more break, and then when I come back, I want to give Jim a chance to talk one more time about that herbicide selection tool.
Sure.
And we'll then talk about your poa day. We'll make a little more fun of your beer and banjo, Ben, and then we'll get you out of here. We'll wrap it up, okay?
Sounds good.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm here live at the New England Turf Conference in Providence, Rhode Island with Professor Jim Brosnan, on the line with Professor Ben McGraw from Penn State University. And Jim, when we left off, as it sort of wandered into lawyer friends and friends of friends and married to people and all of the hallway covered in New England newspaper, I want to wrap this up with a discussion of this one other tool that you have where you can, on your website, herbicides called an herbicide selection tool, you pick the herbicides you've last used for annual bluegrass. This happens to be for annual bluegrass resistance, a big problem in your area where guys are making dormant applications or transition applications to take the poa out, which I got to assume is going to be a bigger problem all the time. So when you go through this, I just put in dithiopyr. I get a list of products that tell me what.
The list that'll populate, it's a list of herbicides that vary in mode of action from what you last applied. So it would position you to have a suite of products to choose from that have a different mode of action from what you last applied, so you're not continuing that selection pressure for a potentially resistant phenotype. But there's some cautions that have to be made here. There's no tolerance information, right? So, you know, if the search that you just did on the website will populate simazine, for example, as a photosystem 2 inhibitor. Yeah. Well, if you're a golf course superintendent in New York and you wanted to go put simazine out for annual bluegrass control, you're going to kill a lot more things than just annual bluegrass. So it's really important that you need to still be thinking and filter through the products that make sense for your area. But this is a way to just narrow down all of the tools that are available into something that's going to be a different mode of action than what last put out on your turf. And that one of the big teaching points here is, and I don't know if they do this in the insecticide world, Ben, but we're trying to get folks to track their group number. So, you know, you think about a spray application record of, okay, I applied this product on this date at this rate to these holes. Well, adding that group number to that record would be really helpful, because then if you're tracking your group number, you're going to know, here's the last group number I put out for that target weed. If I'm going to go treat that target weed again, I can pick something with
a different group number. See, when I hear you talk and I see the lengths you've gone to, it's so disparate from what you say you observe their behavior to be. And that's exactly why I'm sure you're saying we got to educate these guys, because, you know, on the order of priorities on the top 10, essentially herbicides are 11.
Yeah, I mean, I had a conversation with the superintendent this morning who said, you know, he was in my seminar and at one of the breaks came up to me and said, you know, I've never even thought about this resistance issue with weeds before. You know, when I sit down and I build my year, I go through my disease management plan for greens first, then I map out plant growth regulators second, I'll do nutrients third, maybe touch on insecticides because of ABW and grubs after that, and then maybe, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th down the line, I'll start thinking about my herbicides after I get my wedding agents in order.
Exactly right.
And, you know, hopefully, the as more weed scientists and extension continue to speak on this topic, we can get people to maybe you don't need to change the batting order, to use a baseball analogy, but you just need to be able to put the ball in play. It can't be an automatic out, right?
Well, that's right. And I think when you're talking about, I mean, listen, what you guys are both talking about is what everybody's seeing with regard to managing golf courses moving forward as we start to wrap up here. I mean, my sense from listening to both of you guys is what I see in other areas, that everybody's going to be asked to be more thoughtful for a number of reasons. The climate is changing dramatically, causing dramatic shifts in pest profiles, pest behavior. So that is X. Y is, for many years now, the number of insecticide chemistries we're using is shrinking, particularly in some locations. The number of herbicide chemistries we're using are continuing to shrink. But the demand for their use is continuing. So instead of having the diversity of products, we are getting pressure, more pressure with some of our pests, and then using heavier, you know, more tools with selection pressure in the same line more frequently, and the bottleneck continues to go down. Now, I think Long Island is a good harbinger of this. And where you see what happens, where well-intentioned people trying to preserve the environment, why it's important to have a robust conversation about resistance. Because I put in a product for POA control, you tell me what else I can use, not how to make the decision to use it and how to do it. Because some of these are different, completely different strategies, which have to be built around my PGR program and built around my fungicide program. I think as you approach this, the thoughtfulness that these guys have to put in is much more than it used to be. And I've been hounding since I've been here about data. Well, here's two new pieces of data I can add to the decision-making tool. What level of resistance do I have, and how do I build a sort of modern weed management program? And what is the level of resistance to a major pest problem? And I got to tell you, Ben, I'm more hopeful on your end, because I've seen my pals at Bethpage that I've been working with very closely now. When you identified the resistance for them years ago when you were at Delhi, they immediately got nervous. You know, the black course, you can't be messing around when the TV cameras come on. So we immediately, with your information, began to make adjustments. Well, what did they do? They began tracking degree days and monitoring it with their pitfall traps that they installed and the soap flushes that they were doing and counting and writing down and putting information in.
Yeah.
Then they planted phenological indicators. They planted plants that would time right for the stage of the insect. Then they checked with Weevil Track. Then they talk to their pals and see what they're seeing. And they've done this now for 4 or 5 years, Ben. And Andy's got it down now to three of the golf courses made one larvicide application from compared to what you say the industry average is four.
Yeah, and I think as interesting as Long Island is a case study, Bethpage is an even more interesting case study where you've got how many golf courses? Five golf courses?
Five.
Five, and they're all doing different before I got there. In survey, they were doing five different insecticide intensity levels, I guess, from the black being very high to the green being very low, and different levels of resistance, ironically, because this insect does not really move around all that much. It's primarily
I mean, and just so everybody knows, I mean, the black course abuts the
green
course.
And we were pulling samples probably 500 yards apart. Different pressures on those two populations, very different outcome. So that, I mean, that illustrates a lot right there about your management decisions on course. It's, you know, with insects, I think the thing that's different from weeds, what we've been talking about is it's about all we have to do is avoid visible damage. I mean, that's what insect IPM is all about, is just keeping them below a threshold. So unlike a weed that's very apparent, you can have really healthy turf and high densities of weevils and not see damage. So
that's right.
That's good and bad. And yeah. You could be doing that's bad right. things for a long time and not know it. Conversely,
that's exactly right. Yeah, that's right.
You know, conversely, you know, that's all that you have to play to as well.
So I think they're a great case study. I'm hoping to get back there in a month or two and see what they're doing. I'm really interested in their weevils and seeing if resistance can be reversed. I don't know if that's the case in weeds as well. Again, I dropped out of that class, so I can't speak intelligently about that. But
I'll make one more comment, and just so you know, I mean, you reported on it. I saw you report on it when we were in Orlando. But Beth Page does use a fair amount of Civitas now, and your work on the use of that oil as a horticultural oil for insecticide use, I think, is part of the untold story there right now.
True.
And I don't want to wander there, but there's a number of reasons now I'm going to have your banjo playing beer drinking ass back on this podcast, Benjamin.
Yeah, anytime.
All right, so listen, let me wrap it up here with Jim and say, you know, unlike Ben, you're right, he's right. They see the weeds. They see when it works and doesn't work. Obviously, education you've identified to be the key. You've got this cool Facebook Live program coming up. Tell us about this hashtag PoaDay, Jim.
Yeah, so for a number of years, we've done, we used to call it Herbicide Resistance Field Day and realized that all we ever talked about was
POA. And then I went to sleep.
Yeah, so then kind of renamed it POA Day. And this year, wanted to kind of use the technology available through Facebook Live to try to reach a wider audience. So we do statewide annual bluegrass control trials in Knoxville, Nashville, and Memphis. We put the same treatments out and then talk about, well, what were the winners and losers in those statewide trials? And the idea here is to show the end user all of the possible programmatic options they could have for managing annual bluegrass and turf, so they could see the different things that are out there available to them. And the idea with Facebook Live this year was that we could make that available to people far beyond Tennessee. So rather than having 50 or 75 people come to a field day in Memphis, we could have anyone anywhere in the country that was interested in annual bluegrass management might be having a resistance problem join and kind of see what we were working on.
When I hear you say that you're doing it in three locations across the state, the first thing I think is, boy, wouldn't it be cool if you had like an NTEP formulated herbicide resistance program that actually focused on a weed in a particular year like POA, and somebody put a protocol together and sent it to 8 or 10 different weed scientists across the country that did exactly what you did, and then we'd have a scan of its behavior and resistance across the whole country. Is that done or reported? Because what you're onto, I think, Jim, is sort of, what I think Ben's going to need to do, because the behavior of this thing in the Mid-Atlantic is likely different than the behavior in the New England, and now we're seeing it in Michigan.
Without a doubt.
More frequently in Ohio, and Shetler are talking about it. So what about this sort of national way of doing this?
Yeah, I don't know that that's done particularly in weeds in any formalized fashion. I mean, there are certainly collaborations amongst folks who work in weed science that do this, but I don't know of anything really formalized. I'll say that an individual who's done this probably better than anybody recently is Dr. Bill Kreiser from Nebraska in his PGR work, right, and trying to put those PGR trials out across wide geographies to build better growing degree day models for PGR applications on bentgrass. And he's now come into the southern region and reached out to myself and some other folks
about the ridiculous PGR behavior exhibited in the south.
Yeah, that's a topic for a whole other podcast.
And there we go, a reason to have Professor Bryan.
And you know, I think that approach is certainly impactful when you can look at the same treatments across a wide geography and do that. So certainly an area for expansion.
So Facebook Live, what's involved with that? You got a camera crew, you're doing it with your phone. How's that work out?
Yeah, so AquaAid is supporting the event.
Nice.
Bill Brown, who many people listening may know, used to be with Turf Republic, is now with AquaAid, and he's going to kind of quarterback the mechanics of the thing in terms of the filming and the technology, making sure that we're staying all online. And then a couple of students are lined up to kind of handle the questions that might come in and put them in a queue so we can take end user questions online. And, you know, I'm excited for it. I think that there's a real potential here to grow the event. event with the technology. I'll be honest, I'm a little bit nervous. Anything with technology doesn't always go as seamlessly as
well, at
it
least
seems
the
like
people who are there are going to get it.
So, you know, I think if we can make the mechanics of this work out, I'm excited to do it for future POA days, and I think we could do it for other weed science events. You know, you could have a crabgrass day, you could have a yellow nutsedge day, a goosegrass day. Yeah. And then the other thing that's really important here, back on the context of resistance, is that, you know, the end user, we like to think in extension that they get their information directly from us, the extension specialist, but that's not true. All of the surveys out there show that the sales reps and the DSRs are
that's
the ones
exactly
that are
right
providing the end users their information about product performance. And if we can do some trainings right for, you know, DSRs or sales rep nationally yeah that can join in on something using this streaming technology
exactly
to
right
see live
exactly
what's
right
out there in terms of yeah product options,
yeah,
I think that could help.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. I do think that the modern distributor reps, I think that are going to be really successful in the future in this business, are going to be like crop consultants in agriculture. They're not just going to get paid for the products they can sell you through an agency price. They're going to get paid for what they're understanding. And I think both of you guys should be commended, if for nothing else, that you've sort of identified these issues and, in, as a classic extension guy myself, appreciate sort of the methodical way you've gone about addressing the problem, keeping science really at the forefront, recognizing the limitations when you can. But really, your job now is keeping it in the consciousness. This is the problem, because we're always competing. And I got to tell you, I'm very hopeful for this one point. I really think we're about to knock it off with all the nutrient talk. The best podcast, the most listened to stupid podcasts I have are about nutrient management. And I got to tell you, as somebody who studied nutrient management, it has been the most distracting subject of anything we have done in turf. Soil tests don't work effectively. Guys are putting on way more fertilizers than they need, and yet it's all they want to think about. And I think a lot of that is it's because something the DSRs got and understood. And I think what that's led to is they also get good margins on those nutrient products that maybe they don't get with some chemicals. So I do think we have to understand that sort of environment where guys get their information to keep it in their consciousness, because it's really important that you do it. And Ben, thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
I believe off air, I did ask you if at some point you're going to develop a banjo tune for the podcast here, because we're trying to crowdsource some music to build a little community around Frankly Speaking. So we're hoping that we can get a banjo, and even better if you get your daughter to play with you.
Oh my goodness, yes, we'd love to. We'll wait for the check to come in, at least 50% of
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time, Ben. Jim, thanks for being here with me live in Providence at the New England Show. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers.